The Shaq Show is a production of iHeartRadio. Back on March 31st, the National Golf Foundation sent out its first email letter from their CEO, today's guest on The Shaq Show, Joe Bettitz, who's been with the organization since 1984, started as a director of research, and he issued a statement essentially laying out what they would be doing. They surveyed over 1,000 golf courses, and since then, weekly, they've been tracking data, also some feelings, thoughts from people, kind of covering a wide array, really, of I don't want to say random topics, but in a way they are, but in a good way, and trying to understand what's going on with the sport, perceptions of where things stand. And all along, what's been most fascinating to me, I think, is that Dr. Bettitz has been very adamant about reminding people that this is a situation that is highlighting the benefits of golf, but at the same time could really shine a light on the sport if people do not appreciate the privilege of being able to go out and play golf right now as so many terrible things are going on with lives being lost and the economy. And so it's been so refreshing to have somebody in the golf industry that's using data, but also using common sense and thinking big picture and looking beyond all this to what is best for the sport and protecting it, but also trying to push things forward. So I wanted to talk to Dr. Joe Bettitz, who's down in Jupiter, Florida, about where he has seen things go up and to this point and possibly where things are headed into the future. I hope you enjoy the discussion. So I look back on my emails and I saw that the National Golf Foundation started tracking things, Doctor, at the end of March. And I'm just wondering if you can kind of set up for us why the National Golf Foundation started doing this, and you've been doing every week now with these phone surveys of golf courses and I believe of golfers.
It's a little bit of a couple of coincidences. One, you know, we have a pretty large and substantial research staff here at NGF, and in our work that we do, much of the work that we do is private and it's commercial work, proprietary to the companies that we work for. And that's, you know, a significant portion of our work lives here at NGF. The other side is doing things to research the game and the growth of the game, et cetera. So when our proprietary or our commercial projects kind of got put on pause by our client base, I had a lot of research resources, man and woman power to, you know, to apply somewhere. Then, so that was one thing that we had. And then we've got a couple of unique assets. You know, one is a universal database of golf courses in the world. It started as a database of golf courses in the United States way back in 1934 when we got started by the couple of journalists. In fact,
that's right. Joe writers.
Yeah, writers they were in Chicago. Characters, too. Anyway, you know, they published some golf magazines, in fact.
Yes.
But in any case, so we have the database of golf courses. We have the staff, you know, and, you know, the first week I actually hired an outside call agency to make the calls, to do the poll of golf courses. But they came back and they said, well, we weren't able to reach, you know, X number of them. I said, well, we can't just assume that they're closed or open. We have to track them down. So I turned my staff loose on it and they kind of fixed that so that we could definitively say, you know, what was the status of the 1,200 or so golf courses that we called. And then, of course, we found out it was, what, 47-48%, which shocked a lot of people. We were convinced it was correct and that we needed to keep doing it. So that's where that led. And then another asset is we have a consumer panel, a core golfer consumer panel, which, again, we use for a lot of our commercial work, but our non-commercial work as well. And so we decided to start surveying our panel weekly to see how they were holding up, what their anxiety levels were, how itchy they were to get out and play golf, et cetera, to kind of get into their heads a little bit. And so we just started doing it there 6 weeks ago, and now we're in our seventh week, and I can tell you today is Wednesday, and our staff is on the phones with golf courses completing this week's sample, except now we're asking, we kind of switched because, as you know, we're 95% plus open. The ones that are still closed remain so either because they want to be or have to be by a local executive order. So we huddled earlier this week and said, where do we pivot? And so now we're asking golf courses while we're on the phone with them, you know, how open are you? Is the pro shop open? How about the food and beverage? You know, is what does the throughput look like? Are your tee times, lengthened significantly, et cetera? So we'll be reporting on that golf course dimension, and we also will be reporting on a new consumer dimension come next Tuesday. That will go into the field probably tomorrow, a new consumer study from our panel. That will get wrapped up over the weekend. The guys will work on the weekend on it and give me some results on Monday. And you guys out there will get to see it on Tuesday.
You mentioned you were shocked by the number of courses open. Shockingly low or shockingly high number back when you started this, what we're talking about, 6 weeks ago now?
I think high, in answer to your question. In a word, high. I mean, people were incredulous when I told them that we found 48% of golf courses were still open for play.
Interesting. So one of the things that I've noticed in your tone, in your messages has been, I think, superb, but I'm sure it's been tricky for you. But you have really been emphasizing a certain caution, and you've used a paparazzi analogy, and you've used the yellow light, red light analogy. Where's that coming from? What are you seeing either from the people you're talking to or your staff is hearing? What's driving you to say those things as you're writing your weekly letter, setting up the data you're putting out?
Good question, Jeff. Well, it is partly what I'm hearing from people anecdotally, in terms of, I mentioned in this past weekend, the boards of directors, struggling with how to deal with, let's say
members. Say it, Joe. Members.
Members. No, how about if we call them COVIDiots?
Okay. Yeah.
And they're really having to deal with this. Mm. And then I was on the phone literally just before the day before I wrote that on Saturday morning. I wrote that after a few cups of coffee. Somebody called me and they told me about a golf course that was in flagrant violation, that shut down by the sheriff's department, punitively closed for 45 days. And, and a couple of people were arrested in the parking lot, DUI. I left that part out. Mm. And so the bad behavior is going to happen. I think it's going to be small. But think about this. Think about 100 people, even 100 golfers. If you had 100 golfers, do you think like maybe one or two of them, let's say two of them, would kind of not be the kind of person you'd want to set up as a role model for your kids or something like that? I think we could probably assume there were at least a couple out of 100. That would give us about 500,000 of those around the country then as golfers. Mm. If just 2% were, not compliant, let's say not being prudent. So what concerns me, I guess, Jeff, is that from everything that I read, and I read a ton, we're still in the middle of this. We're not even in the, we're in the third quarter, maybe. And this could roll right into, right into a second wave. I'm not a pessimist by nature. I'm an optimist, but I just think we still need to be really careful, both at work and at play. And I think golf is perfectly capable of delivering that safe activity for people. 100% convinced that it is, so long as we kind of self-regulate and, that we look to generate peer pressure as opposed to police pressure at our golf facilities.
Right. But the thing I sense, though, that is also part of your message is that you also have, and I don't know how you survey this or track this, but I also sense you just feel there is a view of the sport that maybe heightens the alert systems of people looking for trouble or wanting to get the game? Or maybe you just sense that because of the way golf is played and the way it looks, that it could look wrong. Is that a little bit of what feeds your cautionary tone?
I think so, Jeff. I mean, I think you're very intuitive there. I mean, there's a certain amount of people. I mean, 90% of Americans do not play golf. Of course, I could argue that 90% don't play tennis either or ski, but 90% don't play golf. And some of them do carry a negative impression. It's not a majority by any means, but they do carry, you know, and proselytize a negative image of the game, and it's this whole divisiveness of the, you know, the 1 or 2 percenters and the vision of, you know, golf behind the gated
right.
You know, gates and walls. When we know, in fact, and NGF has known forever that, you know, golf is a very democratic game. It's available in all places at all price points virtually. I think our consumer research tells us that every golfer that we have in our panel has, you know, 4 to 5 golf courses, you know, within a reasonable driving distance of them, you know, at various price points. I guess maybe I'm a little sensitive to golf being accused of being elitist, although we get to go out and right. exercise and enjoy our sport when everybody else is shut down. I just think that that's a breeding ground for negativity about the game, which I would hate to see happen.
Yeah. So you mentioned the democratic nature, and one of the things that I sense so far, and again, we're very early into this, but it seems like this has a potential to be a renaissance or something that really sparks a kind of a renewal and a sense of appreciation for both the sport, but in particular, public golf. Is that fair to jump to that conclusion, or is it just too early to tell in this dreadful pandemic where things will go?
Well, again, I love the direction of your thinking. I do hear anecdotally, again, from feedback from the material we're sending out and people writing in and calling, saying that they're seeing people at their golf courses that they haven't seen in a long time or ever. That there does seem to be a heightened interest amongst some, not any kind of a decline in interest in golf. And so they're seeing more couples golf, they're seeing more family golf in the places that have been denied the ability to play. Now that they're open, they're seeing full tee sheets. So I do think that there could be a silver lining here in terms of golf's perception of golf and participation. We could sure use that. You know, we won't die without it. I mean, golf's not going anywhere, but it would be nice if more people enjoyed it. That's really what we're all about. More people enjoying the game in the way that they want to enjoy it.
Well, let's take a quick break here. I'm speaking with Dr. Joe Bettitz of the National Golf Foundation, and we'll hear from our sponsors briefly, and we'll continue our chat. All right, we're back. So one of the things that we're looking at as part of this situation where golf courses are open, people are playing. We do have a few bad apples here and there, but for the most part, the reports are just sensational, at least that I'm hearing, of golf courses behaving well, golfers, everything, just being extra careful and sensitive. So one of the things that's going to be added to that, and I don't know how you or if the National Golf Foundation is looking at this or is dreaming of how you ask this question, but professional golf may be making a comeback in early June. And obviously it's going to be a cumbersome task to do that. Do you see a lot of correlation between how people see the pro game and connect it with the recreational game? And is that something we need to watch in case that doesn't go well, or it goes really well? Is there a potential impact on the business of golf and the everyday game?
Great question. Let me share a couple of thoughts on that. First of all, there's absolutely no doubt that broadcast golf, streaming golf, et cetera, enhances interest in the game. It builds interest in the game. We saw that throughout the history of golf. The more exposure golf got, the more popular golf got. From perhaps the exposure of Bobby Jones going through a ticker tape parade in New York City, on the streets of New York City, to, you know, Palmer and Nicklaus dueling it out, or Nicklaus and Watson dueling it out, to Tiger Woods' ascension in the late 90s and into the early 2000s. You know, golf on TV has been a terrific driver, that exposure. Almost 100 million people follow golf, either, you know, play it or watch it or read about it. And that's where the pent up interest in golf, you know, percolates until it, you know, comes to the surface and somebody says, you know, I'm going to give golf a try. So any golf on TV is good for the game, in my opinion. Now, how it comes out in June, I think it'll be just fine. I really do. I mean, we did do some survey work on this amongst our core golfer panel. And while they would prefer, you know, while golfers would prefer to see, you know, an audience, a crowd of spectators, and feel some of that electricity, even if it's digitally only, they still said that they would tune in and they would enjoy it, and that they would jump on it. And I think everybody's looking forward to the match this Sunday. Coincidentally, Jeff, that golf course, Seminole, is 7 miles south of me, due south, on the same road. Right, so it's 7 miles south of me, and Medalist the following week is about 9 miles due north of me on the same road. So our office is smack in the middle of the two golf courses that are going to be featured here in the next 2 weeks.
And you probably can't attend either event, which is fine, by the way.
It could be that the invitation got lost.
No. I think they're being extra safe, which is great.
No, they are going to be super extra safe, and I'm just pleased and looking forward to seeing some of it, you know, myself.
And you mentioned doing some surveying on that. Is that a big part of your? What is it that the people who are looking to you for information generally before this? What is it they're wanting to know? And then now in the pandemic, what is the thing that you're wanting people from the golf business are wanting to hear from you?
Well, you know, before pandemic, you know, people look to us to keep track of, you know, consumer sentiment, spending habits, you know, inclination to, you know, purchase equipment, travel, et cetera. As I say, we serve the commercial side of the game, and our members are all golf related businesses, thousands of them, be they golf courses or be they the biggest manufacturers or the smallest golf course architect. Those are our constituents, from the turf industry and the John Deeres and the Syngentas and, you know, the Toros of the world to, you know, the equipment manufacturers, et cetera. So you can imagine what they're all interested in, what their consumers are thinking and what they might do, what they might want. So we dive deeply into that for them, both, you know, in many different ways, both generally from a macro point of view and also from a very proprietary point of view, you know, by looking at their own and studying their own brand equity, et cetera. So before the pandemic, that's the kind of work we did with the industry, for the industry, everyone, whether they be a client or not. You know, we track golf courses. We track the number of golfers on and off course. You know, we track latent demand or interest in the game. We track spending. We track media consumption and that kind of behavior. And we report that globally to everyone, because anybody in the business of golf needs to have those basic metrics.
Right.
So what's missing now, pandemic-wise, is a lot of that proprietary or private work that's been put on hold as companies, wide and far are you know, cutting back on all discretionary, you know, spending. So we understand that, and we ourselves are doing the same thing.
So,
did I wander completely off?
It's where I was thinking, kind of where I wanted to keep the conversation going, because obviously I would sense, and I think it's just too early, but one of the things you'll be really looked to for more survey work after the great work you guys have done so far is the future. And of course, nobody has a clue where this is going to go. But I would assume, you said you're doing a lot of reading and thinking and hearing from people. I assume is that part of your role, is to the National Golf Foundation to start thinking ahead and seeing some of the trends here and where things may go in the golf business?
I absolutely do. You know, and having been doing this for a while here and knowing the history of the organization pretty well and the folks who've been involved, there's always been a deep commitment to not only research, but also promotion of the game and promotion of the business. You know, we think it's okay that people make a living at golf, and, you know, that we have hundreds of thousands of people that do in all walks of golf life. You know, they count on golf to provide put a roof over their heads. So we promote, and we want to promote the game just because we're golfers. And like you, I'm all for having more people, you know, savor the qualities that this game, you know, that this game provides. I mean, the things that the joy that it can give is, you know, just fantastic. So we do think forward as well, not only with what might happen with golf post virus, but how about if we think about what could happen?
Mm-hmm. So do tell, what do you think? What are you sensing?
Yeah, if it's an inflection point and we have some control, when I say we, I don't mean the National Golf Foundation.
Right.
I mean you and me, Jeff, that we have some control over the direction that golf might take in the future. I'd like to plant that seed in your head and have another conversation with you, seriously, about what are the four or five things that you think would make golf a better game, that would make golf more enjoyable for more people. If you just think about that, I'm serious invitation to discuss that, because I've been thinking a lot about that in the last 6 weeks, and I've got some ideas. Now, I'm not going to sneak too many of those out or any of them right now, but I will love to talk to you about this, at another
yeah,
time, and to hear what you have to think about what would make golf a better game and more enjoyable for more people.
Well, and I think that's one of the tricks in this is, you know, we have to have those conversations, but you also, it feels wrong to be doing that right now, knowing what's going on, and we're still at this point and people are dying every day. It feels a little bit slimy, and at least for me, but at the same time, you'd be foolish not to be starting to project out and think. And it seems like in a lot of other industries, trends that we're developing now are going to be expedited, most, not all. And golf, yeah, certainly had a lot of things going in certain directions. Do you sense that's kind of the same thing, that although this seems so different in some way? I mean, public golf was not viewed in a good light. There was a concern about the future of public golf, and I could make a case, I think today, that I'm more bullish on public golf than I have been in a long time because of this. Is that your sense, though, that some of the things that were trending will probably get kicked up a notch or two and happen even faster?
Well, a couple of thoughts. First of all, I think we're going to limp out of this. We're not going to run out of this.
Yeah.
I think we're going to limp out of it. I think as a national economy, we're going to limp out, and I think as golf economy, it's not going to be, I think, a really fast recovery, but it will be a recovery. You know, I mean, the American economy is going to come through this, and we're going to come through it, and there is another side, and we're going to be, you know, looking forward to getting there. But I don't think it's going to happen, you know, quickly, and I don't think the economy is going to recover in a V-type shape. I think it's going to be a U, and the question is how deep and how wide is the U? And now the trends in the game itself, you know, I think there were some positive trends happening from a public golf.
Oh yeah,
from a public golf point of view.
Yeah,
you know, there's only one category. We look at golf courses, Jeff, in three ways. We look at them in three categories: at daily fee, which is a public golf course owned privately by somebody or some people, private, be it owned by the members or owned by a corporation, doesn't matter, it's private, and then municipal. And municipal golf is a term that goes back way back into the 30s and 40s. In fact, there's a book sitting near my office here, and the title of it is Municipal Golf, A Guide to Operations. Published, by the way, was published by the NGF in 1955.
Wow.
And we've been very involved in municipal golf throughout the history and throughout since we were formed in the 30s. But, you know, the point on municipal golf is it's the only category of golf courses over the last 15 years that has gotten larger, not smaller.
Hmm.
You know, with the closures that we read about, golf course closing, these closures, which we carefully track, by the way, this is a natural market correction. But the one category from the municipal daily fee and private, municipal is the only category that's the same size or slightly larger than it was when this correction started 14 years ago.
Hmm. Wow.
2,500, about 2,500, by the way, 2,500 and a few.
So, and you do track that. I mean, I just saw two courses in Dayton out of three closed.
Yes.
And, you know, you look at a situation like that. And again, I read it. I understand these were issues coming for a long time. But then you also think, wow, what's going on right now? Those two golf courses might be seen in a different light in that community, I would think. But maybe not. They just were fundamentally broken. And as you say, it's part of the correction.
I think it is. I mean, we've worked with hundreds of communities. In fact, Dayton was one of them. We have consultants that work with the cities and with their golf divisions to try to help them figure out the market and where they fit into the market. And, you know, we were a little bit surprised by Dayton that because we didn't recommend that they go quite that far. But obviously, you know, the city has its own financials to worry about. And that's part of what's driving it. Probably the market was definitely part of it. My guess is that that the city's finances drove another part of it. But there's still plenty of golf there. I have to tell you that. There's no dearth. I mean, and the rounds played won't suffer in the Dayton market because those courses closed. But we are sorry to see them go. But you have to be somewhat Darwinian about this in your thinking.
Sure, sure. Let me take one quick break again here, and sure. We'll wrap up this chat with a few general questions with Dr. Joe Bettitz. All right. So one of the things that I noticed in looking through a lot of the data is that you're surveying a lot of different topics, and I'm sure there are things that are there things that you would like to survey and poll and be able to share with the public. That's just a topic that it's just a tough thing to track. Is there something that's just not something that in a survey you can trace in terms of gauging whatever it is, maybe consumer sentiment or the business side or where people are feeling? Because for instance, today you had quite a bit on economic sensibilities and the feeling of golfers and where they feel they'll be. Is there any topic that jumps out as tricky to survey?
It's great that you call it a survey because it could be a survey, but you know, we think a little more broadly than that, like you do. There's lots of ways that one can do research. You know, from surveys are certainly one of them, where we send surveys or we can interview people. We can do focus groups for sure. We can do case studies. So there's lots of ways to apply our research techniques, and we've got a pretty full arsenal of those techniques here at the NGF. One of the more interesting subjects that we're going to be diving into going forward is the customer experience in golf. We're keenly interested in it because we really do think that generally the customer experience in golf could be holding back the potential for growth that we think exists. We think that it could be suppressing it to some extent.
Mm.
And so we're going to be studying the customer experience. And I'm not talking about some of the wonderful places, Jeff, where you and I, you know, have the good fortune of being able to play. I'm talking about the, you know, everyday golf course and what a golfer experiences, let's say an infrequent or casual golfer or a new golfer experiences when they go to that business, and how warmly they are received. And so this is a subject that it's not easy to, this isn't just done with just a simple survey and there you go, there's the answer, everybody act on it.
Right.
It's much more kind of nuanced, than that. We'll involve secret shopping on our part and yes, by all means, research, et cetera, to kind of bring into focus how we might be able to improve the culture of golf for more of our players.
Yeah, no, I think about it a lot when I go to a course and you walk in and either the pro shop is run down or the person behind the counter's intimidating and not welcoming, and you think, gosh, I can handle this, but the person who's new to the game, and the game's so tough as it is and a little bit intimidating and scary, what does that do to them or to a young kid? I see, that's where I think more probably. Although that said, a lot of us got into the game and dealt with cranky starters and all sorts of other things and stayed with it. So maybe it's hard to gauge.
All right. So listen, I went through basic training too, but I didn't ask everybody else to, right?
Right. Is it really, is it a good thing? No.
It was hell for 6 weeks, but I came out a better person.
Yeah.
But I think we could make it easier, to be honest with you. I think we could make it a heck of a lot more fun. And I think we can have a higher conversion rate from interest in golf to trial. In other words, people say they're going to give it a try to conversion. And when that sequence happens right, when that launch sequence happens properly, I'll tell you, our research has shown that people can become totally fanatical golfers, completely hooked, you know, in a period of months. It has nothing to do with their ability or their score. Hmm. It has everything to do with whether they've got the golf gene, you know, in their DNA, and they they're just likely to get hooked, and we don't turn them away. We don't turn them off.
One of the things that I've been hearing and seeing a little bit in person when I've gone over to the local golf course here is that the pace of play has been incredibly good, despite things like cart reductions and people having to use just different things going on. But it seems to literally come down simply to one thing and one thing only, which is tee time spacing. Is this something you have done research on before, or is it something that you're aware of now in this situation where courses have been forced to do 10, 12, 15 minute spacings and found out, oh, wow, that ended that logjam we always have on the fourth tee?
Yeah. We've done a little bit of research. It's been some years since we have, but there's been plenty of research done on, you know, golf course operational research on throughput. And yeah, there's no doubt that every golf course is a little bit different and, you know, has an ideal, but it has every golf course has an ideal pace. And it does have to do with how many people you stick into the funnel at one time. So I'm glad to hear that it's picking up and more people are walking, which is a great benefit. And so we think that's good too.
And you can't find a push cart anywhere online to buy. They're a hot item here in LA.
I can tell you, I've talked to a couple of major retailers who will go unnamed at this point, telling me that that's the hottest product that they have. And I can tell you that I saw push carts at the club that I belong to down here, which is a nice private club with caddies. And we now have push carts. We now have push carts. And they are all taken generally. They are all taken because they couldn't buy enough
right.
of them.
Yeah, the pandemic has ended two of the stranger peccadilloes that golfers have had, country clubs and push carts and people changing their shoes in the parking lot. So there's that.
That's for the better, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, it's ridiculous why places would. Those were the kinds of things that would turn people off who you would tell that to who weren't as familiar with the game, just not understanding why those things were exactly. So odd. Right. So in this time when you're doing all this, are you reading a lot of things about golf, or are you looking outside to other sources for inspiration?
Well, besides reading your stuff every morning, which I do, by the way.
Oh, thank
about
you.
6 in the morning here, about 3 in the morning your time. I'll be looking at your stuff every single morning and looking at your commentary, and you kind of help me, you sift through the and pull forward the interesting stuff. You kind of curate, things that interest you, and they happen to interest me generally too. There's a couple of other sources like that. So I do keep pretty close track of what's being written in golf. But I also do read outside of golf. A book that's very relevant to me recently is a book called Culture by Design. And this book was written by a fellow by the name of David Friedman. And I commend this book to you and others to take a look at. It's a very, very well written, very easy to read and understand. And what I like is it's easy to implement. As my senior staff here will know, because they've all been given a copy of the book and have all had to come up with what we're going to be calling the NGF fundamentals. These are the fundamental things that drive our behavior here at the National Golf Foundation. Not just the things on the wall that we all have, those mission, vision statements, but these are the actual behaviors that are going to be reinforced here at NGF. And as I got to thinking about how NGF's culture could improve, even though it's fantastic right now, it could still get better. I've been thinking about how the culture at our golf courses could improve.
Mm.
And how when somebody walked into that place, it was like walking into a Chick-fil-A.
Mm.
By the way, one of my top recommendations, we need to be hiring more people from the Chick-fil-A stores and putting them behind the pro shop counters. And we need to get our golf pros out onto the driving range, identifying new golfers, which is pretty easy, by the way. You and I can do it. And giving them little quick mini lessons words of encouragement. But anyway, Culture by Design is something that I've read that I think is a great thing for us to be thinking about. And, maybe the subject of another conversation one day.
Yeah, no, absolutely. You do sense that the great places in the game, there is a culture and a mission that's you just feel it when you're there, and other places you don't. And a lot of those places survive because they're in spite of their culture, because they're well located, or it's a good design, or it's affordable. I want to throw one last question at you. I this is a little bit out of the blue, probably one that's unfair to ask, but if golf started from scratch today, how many holes would you say, based on your, I believe, is it 36 years with the National Golf Foundation of looking at a lot of data? How many holes would it be? The average normal golf course, would it be 18?
I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think it'd be less. I'd certainly like it to be less now myself, but I think if you could start it over, of course, we would do some different, and you're the expert on this. We do some things different about design, wouldn't we?
Sure, sure.
And about, and about how quickly the game could be played. I think that we would try to keep it to a length that the game could be played in 2.5 or 3 hours, the way it used to be played, while walking. And where there's a tee and then a green and a tee and a green, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think it would be shorter, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, I feel like it's 12 that's the sweet spot. The 9's not enough, but 12's just the right amount.
I love that idea. I was going to say dozen, an even dozen. I love the thought of 6 and 6, to be honest with you, because even walking, I just like it. You're right. 12 is just about perfect.
Although I think what you touched on is the more important point. It's that it's the time. I think most people start to find themselves now. They're no matter how focused or how little they have in the way of obligations, that there's something about that 2.5 hour, 3 hour point where the attention span starts to go. And I used to think that was a negative, saying something about our culture, but I don't I don't think it is anymore. I think it just really is about, given the game, the difficulty of it and all the things that go into it, it's a fairly normal reaction.
Yeah. And I think it's the future too. I mean, I don't think that time compression in our lives is going to relax.
Even though we're experiencing this moment right now where people are having a little more time, and some people, frankly, are enjoying the lack of that hurried, you know, got to be doing something all the time feeling. I don't know how long they're going to enjoy it, but your sense is that won't change after this?
No, I think the mega trend towards, you know, constant engagement, not being able to get away from work, constantly checking your email,
right,
or take, you know, looking at your iWatch. You know, I mean, I think that the blurring of the lines between work and home, and for a lot of people, that's even true today. I mean, I know my staff who have been working at home for a month and a half now, going on 2 months, they feel like they're working, you know, around the clock almost.
Mm.
You know, that there's no, you know, been little break. Of course, we've been a safer at home state, so they've been fairly, you know, sequestered. But I think that mega trend of time compression and, you know, the abundance of choice and how just I don't think it's going to get any better. I think golf can be a great respite from that rat race.
Right.
I think it can be a great respite, but I don't think that it can be a 5-hour respite.
Right, right. Well, I can't thank you enough for taking the time and all the great work you're doing. I will obviously link to the website and continue to highlight what is just fascinating research, and I look forward to some of the other topics that the National Golf Foundation probes here in the coming weeks and months.
Fantastic, Jeff. It's been great talking with you. I look forward to another conversation. And do me a favor, remember, I'd like you to think of a handful of things that you think would make golf more enjoyable to more people.
Deal. All right. Well, thank you again to Dr. Joe Beditz. I really appreciate his time, and I will link a few things in the show notes. That book, Culture by Design, sounds quite interesting. And also, of course, if you go to my website, jeffshackelford.com, I've been putting up in the every week when they post their National Golf Foundation findings. And this week, it's 91% of courses are open. And there are some interesting results in the graphs and data shared about consumer sentiment and safe distancing and all sorts of interesting things that for anybody in the golf business, you'll want to see if you're not tracking. And I do think it's fascinating and will be fascinating to see what they touch on here in the coming weeks and what he mentions in his letter. So I'll keep sharing all that, as always, on my website. And again, The Shack Show, thank you again to everybody for listening, and especially to iHeartRadio and to the show's producer, Tim Porochka, for putting this all together. The Shack Show is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows. And I'll be back soon with another Shack Show. Thanks for listening.